23-year-old Dale Dinwiddie was looking forward to a concert. U2 were playing at the Bryce Williams Stadium, home of the University of South Carolina Gamecocks, and Dale had been invited by a group of friends. The concert took place on Wednesday, September 23, 1992, and would sadly be the last concert Dale would ever attend. After the show, Dale and friends went to the Five Points area of Columbia, South Carolina, dropping in at Jungle Jim's, a bar popular with USC students. Sometime after midnight, Dale found herself separated from her friends, and when they couldn't find her, they'd assume she'd gone home. Searching for her group, Dale left the bar. The bouncer was the last person to see her and noted that she was heading north towards a nearby intersection. The next morning, her parents discovered that she hadn't come home, and after calling everyone they could think of, they filed a missing persons report. Over the course of the next 27 years, investigators, family, and reporters alike have been baffled by the utter lack of evidence. Police didn't even have a crime scene, and for the most part, were searching in the dark. What happened to Dale Dinwiddie? Did she fall victim to a random act of violence? Could a serial killer have been targeting her? Or is it possible that someone she knew and trusted holds the answers? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 91, The Disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the incredibly baffling disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. 23-year-old Dale Dinwiddie went to a concert on her college campus and never came home. Nearly 30 years later, and not even a single suspect has ever been officially named. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 91, The Disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie. Dale Boxley Dinwiddie was born on April 12, 1969, to parents Dan and Jean. Dale would be the Dinwiddies' first child, with a second, a son named Drew, coming 7 years later in 1976. Dale was a sweet and caring child whom her parents adored. As their sole child for a period of time, Dale received a great lavishing of attention and was raised in a very loving and comforting environment. When Dale was still quite young, her parents had a home built in the Forest Hills neighborhood of Columbia, South Carolina, in which they would raise their children. Columbia is the capital of South Carolina and the state's second largest city, boasting a population of more than 130,000 residents in 135 square miles. The historic Forest Hills neighborhood of Columbia is known as a nice area seated slightly to the east of Columbia proper. Columbia itself exists in an area of the state known as the Midlands, existing as the halfway point between the Lowcountry and the Upstate. The Forest Hills neighborhood is somewhat of a Midland itself, tucked between wealthy areas of town and blue-collar neighborhoods, with a Greenville News article describing it as, quote, straddling the line between affluence of Forest Acres and the poverty on the other side, end quote. Forest Hills is a beautiful area and to some is a perfect place to raise a family. By the time Dale's younger brother came along, the 7-year-old had developed into a bright and driven child with a gleaming spark of personality. In an article written by Tracy Glantz, Dale is described as feisty and upbeat. In most places, Dale is described as smart, focused, and compassionate. Dale was quiet and introspective, but also fun and excitable. A former teacher described her as the type of person people wanted to be around, noting her charisma and charm. Dale's personality was bigger than her body, with the young woman growing to stand at only 5 feet tall. But if she had something to share, she certainly learned to speak up and get the attention she needed despite her small frame. At the same time, there were those who would describe Dale as timid. Her former English teacher, Jim Gass, spoke about a school trip to England, during which time many of the students were eager to go off exploring on their own, but not Dale. Gass told the Greenville News, quote, "She was the type of student who was reluctant to launch out in the city without me," end quote. Dale would go on to attend Heathwood Hall Episcopal School, which is described on its official website as "abiding commitment to building strong relationships between students and teachers allows us to meet each child where they are in their educational and developmental journey." The school itself, located in the 3,000 block of Beltline Boulevard, sits on a beautiful plot of land, the campus marked by lush greenery. While it might look beautiful, to Dale, it could all be a little challenging. Dale suffered from asthma and severe allergies, so much so that she required an inhaler in addition to injections twice a week. Despite the drawbacks of those allergies, Dale didn't seem much interested in allowing them to stunt her development or her interests. She'd always been drawn to horses, and before she'd even reached the age of 10 years old, she convinced her mother to give horseback riding a shot. And this would develop into a bond they would share, going on to ride together frequently and for many years. Dale rode a horse named Double Time, which she would keep until her graduation from high school. According to the Greenville News, Double Time was sold in order to help pay for Dale's tuition. Initially, Dale intended to matriculate at the University of Georgia with an interest in art, but she quickly found her allergies worsened in the area, and so she shifted gears, and in the fall of 1987, went into college at Randolph-Macon Women's College, located in Virginia. Today, known as Randolph College, the campus went co-ed in 2006, despite the protests of students and alumni alike. Dale had always shown an interest in art, and so her time at Randolph was spent in pursuit of a degree in art history. In the spring of 1991, Dale would achieve her goals, earning her degree, at which time she'd return home to Columbia, beginning her adult life looking for jobs in art restoration. Unfortunately, it wasn't a great time for new job seekers, with the economy being flat. In hopes of expanding her opportunities, Dale moved to Charlotte and eventually found a job, though not doing exactly what she'd intended. Unfortunately, this job lasted less than half a year before the business went under, and Dale returned to Columbia, moving back into the family home in the winter of 1992, a few months before her 23rd birthday. Dale was close with her family, who supported her throughout her attempts to find her footing in her career. Dale's brother Drew described his relationship with his older sister as developing more the older he got. When Drew came along, Dale was 7 years old, and so, in his own words, the two weren't super tight. But as he grew older, he found himself able to relate and connect to her, as well as her friends, which seemed to open the door up to a closer relationship. Until that time, though, Drew referred to himself as the annoying little brother. I grew up with a brother 6.5 years older than me, and I can certainly attest to my abilities as the annoying little brother. I think I still hold that title. Sadly, the development of the relationship between Dale and Drew, though, would be severed by her mysterious disappearance. After moving back home, Dale picked up odd jobs, mostly babysitting, while at the same time volunteering at the Columbia Museum of Art. As it would turn out, Dale's job as a babysitter would put her in direct contact with a woman who would later play a vital role in helping to bring attention to her case. Kathleen Parker is a columnist for the Washington Post, and Dale would, for a time, babysit Parker's eldest son. Ultimately, Dale had bigger dreams, and much of her work during this time was in preparation for her entrance into graduate school at the University of South Carolina. According to friends and family, Dale hoped that by the time she finished graduate school, the job market may have improved. Sadly, Dale would never get the ability to fully explore those possibilities as she would vanish before completing graduate school, just 7 months after returning from Charlotte. In September of 1992, Dale was excited when a friend invited her to attend a concert along with a dozen others. The show, scheduled to take place on Wednesday, September 23rd, would be held at Williams-Brice Stadium, the home stadium for the South Carolina Gamecocks. On this particular night, however, there would not be a football game. Instead, the popular band U2 were coming to town as part of their Zoo TV tour following the release of their 1991 album, Octung Baby, which had produced such memorable hits as Mysterious Ways and One. I should note, I keep seeing this tour referred to as Zootopia, but according to U2's official website, they've never had a tour with that name. According to their site, on September 23rd, 1992, they were in Columbia, South Carolina, performing on the outside broadcast leg of their Zoo TV tour. Dale was looking forward to the show, which she was set to attend along all of her friends. The 5-foot-tall, 96-pound 23-year-old still maintained the aforementioned trait of preferring to be around others when making an outing for the evening, so with so many friends going along, it seemed like the perfect scenario. As a student at USC, Dale was familiar with the stadium, and no one could possibly have imagined she wouldn't return home. The concert was a major event at the time, with tickets selling out and many who couldn't attend the show choosing to gather around outside, partying together, and listening to the echo of the music. The show opened with a performance by Big Audio Dynamite, followed by Public Enemy, before U2 themselves took to the stage. Attendance that evening was listed at 28,305, and U2 would perform 20 songs, followed by a 4-song encore, ending the evening with the powerful Can't Help Falling in Love. According to multiple articles and Dale's listing on the Charlie Project, the show ended at approximately 11:15 p.m. However, for Dale and her friends, the night was still young, and they had plans to enjoy themselves a little bit longer. After the show, Dale and her friends traveled approximately 2.5 miles to the northeast of the stadium, proceeding into the Five Points area. Five Points is known as a mecca for stores, restaurants, and bars and nightclubs. Five Points is hugely popular with students at USC, due in part to its proximity to campus and also the easy availability of alcohol and people looking to have a good time. While this area frequently drew a large number of college-age partiers, it was also an area noted for not exactly being the safest part of town. Located at 724 Hardin Street, Jungle Jim's was a bar and club popular with locals. While many college students went on to other bars in the area, the ones more popular with the college crowd, Jungle Jim's was sort of a local secret. While it drew in crowds of all kinds, there was more of a laid-back and relaxed atmosphere at Jungle Jim's. Over the course of the next few hours, Dale and her group of friends were in the bar, drinking, talking, and having a good time. As the hours slowly ticked by, members of their party began drifting apart, making their ways home. At some point that night, Dale ended up separated from her friends and soon found herself alone in the bar. While her friends had looked for her, they'd failed to find her, and so at approximately 1 a.m. on Thursday, September 24th, the final group of them came to the conclusion that Dale had either caught a ride home with someone or called her parents to come and get her. So they left the bar, heading back to their respective homes and dorms. Reportedly, it wasn't uncommon for Dale to call her parents for a ride when needed, even late in the night. According to the Greenville News, it would take a while, but walking home from that area wasn't out of the question for Dale either, at least in terms of distance. This path, however, would take her through several areas that were less than safe. It was around this time that Dale was engrossed in trying to locate her friends, and whether by poor luck or due to some other reason, she'd managed to miss them before they went on their ways. Shortly after her friends left, Dale approached the bar's bouncer and asked if he'd seen the group she'd come in with. The bouncer explained to Dale that he hadn't seen the group she was looking for, and so he watched as she walked out of the bar, heading down the road to look around and see if she could find them. Unable to locate the group, Dale returned to the bar, speaking once again with the bouncer, before heading back inside to make one final sweep, hoping to find at least one of her friends still inside, but it was to no avail. Finally, at approximately 1:15 a.m., Dale exited the bar for the final time and exchanged a few small words with the bouncer. While notations about this time vary, all are approximate, and it's believed that the last sighting of Dale took place between 1:15 and 1:30 a.m. The bouncer, the last man to see the young woman, reported that she exited Jungle Jim's and then proceeded north on Hardin Street, last being seen at the intersection of Hardin Street and Green Street. This intersection is just one block north of Jungle Jim's. Mysteriously, Dale Dinwiddie seemed to vanish into the city in the early morning hours and has never been seen again. At approximately 6:15 a.m. on Thursday, Dale's father Dan woke up to begin his normal morning routine. While moving around the house, Dan heard noise coming from his daughter's bedroom. As he pushed the door open, he found the light was on in the room and music could be heard playing from her radio. While this was a little out of the ordinary, what truly caught his attention was the bed. It was obvious from looking at it that Dale hadn't slept in the night before, and it was highly unusual for her to not be in her bed this early in the morning. While concerned but not immediately panicked, Dan went back into the master bedroom, at which time he woke his wife, Jean, and told her that Dale didn't appear to have returned home from the concert. Believing it possible that she stayed over with a friend, the pair began making calls to all of Dale's friends, and with each subsequent call, it became more clear that not only had Dale not spent the night with a friend, but none of her friends knew where she was. Those who had attended the concert with her last reported seeing her between 12:30 and 1 a.m. After spending nearly 2 hours making calls, becoming more concerned each time they hung up, Jean and Dan made the frightening decision to contact the Columbia Police Department to report their daughter missing. Initially, the response from police wasn't exactly on par with the concern displayed by her parents. The conversation went along the lines of the police making note that since Dale had attended a concert with friends, there was a good chance she'd gone out afterward and probably crashed at a friend's place, simply forgetting to call her parents or thinking she'd be up and around early in the morning to let them know. Dan and Jean, to their credit, argued against this and explained to police that this was highly unlike Dale. She never stayed out without calling, and she certainly wouldn't have gone this long into the morning without either coming home or notifying her parents of her whereabouts. Finally, police took the missing persons report and assigned an investigator. One of the first investigators assigned to the case was a man by the name of Harold Chambers. Chambers was, if nothing else, an extremely devoted investigator who took his cases personally and was determined to get to the bottom of every mystery that came across his desk. Oftentimes, in cases such as these, we see errors performed by law enforcement, a lack of action, or even ambivalent investigators, but this was certainly not the case with Chambers. There were few as dedicated to their jobs working for the Columbia Police Department, and over all these years later, the Dinwiddie family still credits Chambers with being an incredibly supportive and focused investigator. Chambers had no way of knowing it, but he was taking the first steps into an investigation which would stick with him until his last breath, and he would encounter a family in their hour of need, growing to become almost a member of that family over the next 12 years. From the get-go, the search for Dale was set to be a difficult one. There were no direct witnesses who could attest to seeing Dale after she walked away from Jungle Jim's. None of the friends she'd been with that night had seen her in the hour leading up to her disappearance, and the last person to see her was a bouncer who didn't know Dale beyond the short conversations they had about her friends that night. As Police Chief Charles P. Austin put it when speaking with TheState.com, quote, "We don't have a crime scene. We don't even know if a crime has been committed," end quote. While there's no evidence to support that a crime had taken place, it didn't take the Columbia Police Department very long to classify Dale's disappearance as a kidnapping. While they had no suspects, the information they gleaned from friends and family made it clear that Dale was not the type of person to just walk away, and if she wasn't contacting her family, it had to be due to an inability to do so, not a conscious choice. A thorough and exhaustive search was conducted in the area surrounding Jungle Jim's, and while investigators were able to locate Dale's purse, apparently left behind at the bar, they found little, if anything else. It may be easy to forget, in retrospect, But Dale's disappearance took place in 1992. This was before the age of cell phones, social media, and before the boom of the internet. What could be done to garner attention and spread the word was somewhat limited, though Dan and Jean got themselves in front of every camera and reporter they possibly could to bring as much attention onto the story of their missing daughter as they could. Inside of the first few weeks of Dale's disappearance, the entire state of South Carolina became aware of her story. Missing persons flyers were mass-produced and began appearing everywhere. Students from Heathwood volunteered to help spread awareness, contributing by passing out flyers and standing around Columbia holding up signs bearing Dale's likeness. The Dinwiddies even managed to get Dale's story featured on America's Most Wanted, though the segment would run for only 1 minute. U2, the band, to their credit, displayed Dale's image on a large screen and gave details of her case at a concert a few weeks after her disappearance. There weren't many places, if any, that a person could go in South Carolina without hearing Dale's name or seeing her picture. Sadly, despite all of that coverage, nothing developed. Despite a lack of evidence or a crime scene to investigate, police worked diligently to try and determine what may have happened. Due to the attention being shined on the case, authorities were on the receiving end of more than 300 tips inside of the first 10 days. Tracking down all leads would prove challenging, but it was an effort they were focused on, and despite consistent calls, none of those tips led to any developments. Inside of the first 2 weeks of the investigation, authorities managed to interview more than 100 individuals, though no one seemed to be in possession of any new information beyond what investigators already knew. They found a lot of people who knew Dale, but not a single person who knew what may have happened to her. The South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, also known as SLED, is a state investigative body that often contributes to investigations conducted by various state agencies. SLED got involved in Dale's case, with SLED spokesman Hugh Munn responding to questions about leads, saying, quote, "It's just been an awful lot of rumors of bodies being found in various locations, but there's nothing to it. It's very typical of these kinds of cases," end quote. Beyond the Columbia Police and SLED, the investigation into Dale's disappearance also drew assistance from the Richland County Sheriff's Office, as well as the FBI. With the large number of tips being called in, it was too much for just one department to handle. Unfortunately, running down all the leads was extremely time-consuming, and when they led to dead ends, it only added to the frustration law enforcement was feeling. Police found themselves going down into sewer systems and searching through abandoned houses in the area that Dale had last been seen in. They received information which they hoped would lead to a break. Several witnesses reported seeing a man forcing a woman into a vehicle in the early morning hours in the Five Points area. However, after tracking down that man, it was quickly discovered that the woman was his girlfriend, and they were also able to locate and speak with her. When asked about this later, Chambers stated, quote, "It sounded really good to start with. We thought we had it, but it fizzled out on us like so many more have," end quote. A benefit concert was held at Jungle Gyms to raise money for a reward, reaching $50,000. And yet, despite the offer, none would come forward with the information necessary to claim that money. Most of the calls into police were about unknown individuals who appeared to be strange, or who may have been in the area that night, but there was never anything to connect them to Dale. A lot of those who called in leads simply said things along the lines of seeing someone they thought looked shady, but when asked if they saw that person anywhere near Dale, the answer was always no. The more time passed, it seemed, the less information could be found. As the days began turning into weeks, in desperation, both law enforcement and the Dinwiddie family began considering the thoughts and words of so-called psychics who reached out about the investigation. But again, there was absolutely nothing solid which could be developed. One psychic pointed towards a lake in which a car was found, though no connection to Dale was made. Another's suggestion resulted in ground-penetrating radar being used at a private property where bones were discovered but were later confirmed to belong to an animal. At one point, a home in Five Points had its floors ripped up after new tenants complained of a foul odor. But again, this was another dead end. As Dan Dinwiddie told the Greenville News, it was as simple and disturbing as one day she was there, one day she wasn't. Unfortunately, there was little that law enforcement or the family could do despite their sincerest efforts. For the next 8 years, the investigation continued to be worked, though the more time passed, the fewer resources could be devoted to it. For the Dinwiddies, they continued to remain active in the media and held events on the day of Dale's disappearance each year, though by the 5-year mark, they were beginning to pull back. The loss of a child is already an incredibly difficult situation to deal with, but being so heavily involved in the media and holding all of the events was hard on the family. They found it necessary to pull back, to give themselves some breathing room. While for the first few years, Dan and Jean rushed to the phone every time it rang in hopes of news, by the end of the 90s, they were still hopeful for developments, but could no longer afford the emotional expense of expecting answers at the end of each ring. For Drew, it was completely a surreal experience. He was 16 when his sister vanished, and the impact on the family was clear. According to Drew, his parents tried to protect him from the case, but at the same time felt it important to give him updates and to keep him informed. In response to the tragedy, Drew was given a little more freedom to live life as he saw fit, though according to an article by The State, his parents did insist that he carry a pager and later a cell phone so they could maintain constant contact with him, if need be. When asked about the family's choice to pull back slightly from the media, Drew responded, quote, "We want answers more than anything. We haven't forgotten about Dale and won't," end quote. In mid-2000, authorities received the first possible break in the case when Ronaldo Rivera was arrested. Arrested in Georgia, Rivera, a former Navy pilot and member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was suspected of having killed at least 4 women between Georgia and South Carolina. Rivera was found in a hotel room, having slashed his own wrists, after a woman he had assaulted helped police track him down. Luckily enough for investigators, they were able to get Rivera into custody, his suicide attempt failing. After announcing the arrest of Rivera, more than 30 women came forward and claimed to have been approached by Rivera or even assaulted by him. In most instances, Rivera captured victims by pulling up beside them in his car where he would claim to work for a modeling agency. Through interrogation, authorities were able to locate the remains of 2 victims, with the remains of 2 others having been discovered previously. The remains were located in remote, wooded areas on the border between South Carolina and Georgia. In addition to those 4 crimes, Rivera was investigated as possibly being the man responsible for 15 unsolved homicides in Cumberland County. 6 of the 15 cases involved sex workers who had disappeared or been murdered between 1987 and 1999. While Rivera had stabbed several victims in more recent years, the Cumberland County victims had almost all been strangled. The possibility of a connection between Rivera and Dale came when it was discovered that, at the same time Dale vanished, Rivera was a student attending USC and living in Columbia, South Carolina. Unfortunately, no link could be developed between Rivera and Dale beyond that, and despite multiple interrogations, Rivera denied any involvement in Dale's disappearance. When Rivera had attempted suicide, he left behind a note listing victims' names, but Dale's name was not included on that list. While he seemed like a good possibility, no evidence has ever been found, and Rivera has maintained his innocence in Dale's case. Rivera was ultimately sentenced for his crimes and sent to death row. By this point in time, files on Dale's case had expanded, being comprised of an entire filing cabinet and multiple boxes stacked nearby. Over the years, several individuals have claimed responsibility for Dale's disappearance, but when investigators turn up the heat, they either recant those statements or are unable to provide information to convince police that they were actually involved. Then, there are those that have made the terrible choice to play pranks on investigators. In one particular incident, police received a tip that Dale's remains would be found buried off Fish Hatchery Road, where Chambers arrived and saw mounds of recently disturbed earth. After investigators called for equipment to dig, the mounds were dug up, but nothing was found in them. The tip, which was traced back to a phone on the campus of USC, had come in on April Fool's Day. When asked about whether or not he believed Dale could still be alive, Chambers responded, quote, I'd love to see her walk through the door like that little Smart girl. Who knows? The day before Elizabeth Smart was found, no one knew if she was alive. End quote. In the early 2000s, Harold Chambers encountered medical issues related to cancer. These issues required surgery, and Chambers had to move to part-time with the Columbia Police, but it never stopped him from thinking about Dale, nor trying to determine what may have happened to her. As soon as he had the ability, he was back on his feet and working the case. After surgery to remove a brain tumor, rumors began circulating that Chambers would retire, but when asked by a reporter, Chambers responded, quote, "I won't retire until I find that girl," end quote. True to his word, Chambers continued to track down leads and to exist as a major supporter of the family until he finally lost his health battles. In March of 2004, Chambers passed away at the age of 62. He had refused to retire until his dying day. When asked about Chambers, Gene stated, quote, "He would always tell me, 'We can do this. We can do it together. You don't have to do it yourself. I don't think this family would have made it this far without this man," end quote. While Dale's case remains open, for the most part, things have grown very quiet around her. 10 years after Chambers passed away, on the 22nd anniversary of Dale's disappearance, for the first time in years, law enforcement released an age-progressed photograph of Dale as she might appear now in her early 40s. Several age-progressed photos have been released in hopes of reigniting the investigation. For years, law enforcement elected not to produce those images, believing it unlikely that Dale was still alive. But after 2 decades, it was hoped that anything new might get the investigation rolling again. The Dinwiddie family made public pleas around this time, even offering their private phone number to the public should anyone want to call them with information. After more than 20 years, Jean was asked about what she believed and responded, quote, "I don't know that Dale is safe or where she is. I don't really think that someone from Mars came here and took her. 20 years after the abduction of my child, I still cannot rest easy because I don't know where she is," end quote. A terrible crime just this past year brought Dale's name back into the headlines. 21-year-old Samantha Josephson used her phone to order an Uber at approximately 2 a.m. on Friday, March 29th, 2019. The Uber had been ordered after Samantha had been separated from her friends during a night out in Columbia. Samantha climbed into a black Chevy Impala as it pulled up to the curb, but was completely unaware that this was not the Uber she had ordered. Sadly, Samantha entered the vehicle of 24-year-old Nathaniel David Rowland. Samantha's remains were recovered hours later by turkey hunters in a wooded area southeast of Columbia. Thanks to cameras, cell phone triangulation, and other new technologies, they were able to track down and arrest Rowland. How different might things have been for Dale had these technologies existed when she vanished? Gene Dinwiddie can't help but wonder. The Dinwiddie family expressed their sincere condolences to the Josephson family, understanding far too well what it is like to lose a child in Columbia. Dale Dinwiddie disappeared from the Five Points area of Columbia, South Carolina on September 24, 1992, and she has been missing for 27 years. Due to the mysterious nature of her disappearance, the absence of any evidence or even a crime scene, little has truly been learned about the possibilities beyond the idea that almost anything is possible. In the nearly 30 years since Dale disappeared, only a handful of theories have been considered solid possibilities. The first theory argues that Dale was likely the victim of a completely random abduction and attack from an unknown assailant. The common belief is that, while walking away from Jungle Jim's, Dale may have been approached by someone who forced the young woman into his vehicle. The second theory considers the possibility that Dale may have been a victim of convicted killer Reynaldo Rivera, who's currently sitting on death row after being convicted of 4 murders, though he is suspected in more than 20. Rivera was a USC student at the same time as Dale. The third and final theory argues that Dale may have been the victim of a crime perpetrated by someone she may have known or trusted. Dale was shy and timid, unlikely to go along with someone she didn't know, and for many, That suggests the possibility that she may have gotten into a car for a ride home with someone she thought she'd be safe with. Dale Dinwiddie was last seen at the intersection of Green and Hayden Streets in Columbia, South Carolina. At the time of her disappearance, Dale was 23 years old, standing 5 feet tall and weighing approximately 96 pounds. Dale is a Caucasian female with light brown hair, which at the time had blonde highlights, and brown eyes. Dale has pierced ears, dimples in her face, and one finger on each of her hands has a slight deformity, being curved. When last seen, Dale was wearing a long-sleeve, olive-colored pullover shirt, a bright blue nylon L.L. Bean jacket tied around her waist, faded blue jeans, and either brown boots or possibly white Nikes with a blue stripe. Dale suffers from severe asthma and allergies and requires twice-weekly injections and the use of an inhaler. It's considered possible that, at the time of her disappearance, Dale was not in possession of her inhaler. The disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie is the oldest unsolved missing persons case in the state of South Carolina. The brilliant, loving, and sweet young woman vanished when she was just 23, just beginning her life. If alive today, Dale would be 50 years old. What might she have become? What achievements may she have earned? Jean can't help but wonder about the life her daughter could have lived had it not been stolen from her. She wonders what Dale would have been in her career and in her personal life. An architect? A business owner? A mother? Something completely unpredictable? Unfortunately, the answers to those questions are just as unknown as the truth of what became of Dale. Sadly, Dale's fate may never be discovered, and Jean is highly aware of it, saying, quote, "It just seems like it's forever. We're still waiting and hoping that something comes up." The disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie is one of those cases that's incredibly frustrating in that there's almost no information to work with. There's so little information that I almost didn't cover the case. I didn't want the episode to be extremely short, but my hope was that drawing attention to Dale's story might aid in bringing more information to the surface. What we know is fairly limited, that Dale walked out of a bar after 1 a.m., headed north towards an intersection, and was never seen again. As police stated multiple times during their investigation, they didn't really have a square one to begin with. They knew that Dale had left the bar, but beyond that, there was almost nothing known for certain. Once Dale walked up the road, she could have turned at that intersection and gone in any direction. From that point on, she could have run into someone she knew, been accosted by a stranger, or maybe even gotten into or been forced into a vehicle. At that time, she could have been taken anywhere. One thing that was clear early on in the investigation was that this was not a case of someone who chose to walk away. Oftentimes, when an adult disappears, that's one of the first things investigators mention, but not here. Dale was focused on the future, working towards grad school and had a career she wanted to pursue. She was close with her family and friends, and very much not the type of person to just walk away. Dale didn't appear to be the type of person who liked to go off on her own, and this made it even less likely that her disappearance could have been a conscious choice. Almost immediately, detectives listed her case as a kidnapping, and nearly 30 years later, we're still in a similar place. So what could have happened here? How does someone just disappear into thin air? Over the nearly 3 decades since Dale was last seen, a handful of theories have been suggested, but even they are wide open. The first theory explores the possibility that Dale may have been the victim of a random act of violence. The Five Points area of Columbia, South Carolina in 1992 wasn't exactly the safest area. It was a place known for shopping and bars, and while groups of people seemed to be just fine, several locals noted it was not the kind of place you'd want to be wandering around on your own in the early morning hours. Here we have Dale, all of 5 feet tall and 96 pounds, on her own in the Five Points sometime after 1 a.m., It isn't hard to imagine any number of possible scenarios involving a random person who may have seen Dale as an easy target. What makes this theory all the more disturbing is that, There's a good chance whoever may have been in the area that night and responsible for Dale's disappearance was a local, or at least someone living in the area at that time, who could possibly still be there. Looking at true crime, this is a scenario you see a lot. A single person disappearing without leaving a trace behind. Each time is more frustrating than the last, and the idea that someone can vanish without leaving so much as a clue behind is utterly devastating both to the family and to investigators. Searches were conducted all over that area and nothing was ever found, which seems to suggest that wherever Dale went, she went before being injured or attacked directly, at least to the point that any kind of evidence could be left behind, such as blood or torn clothing. To me, and to many others looking at this case, that would imply that Dale was likely forced into a vehicle or willingly got into one, with the potential crime occurring at a later time in a different location. Columbia sits near several areas that a person could be taken to in a short period of time where there's unlikely to be anyone else around. Congaree National Park, which encompasses more than 26,000 acres of land and dense forestry, is only 17 miles to the southeast of Jungle Jim's. Lake Murray, a reservoir covering more than 50,000 acres, was just 17 miles to the west. If the perpetrator had driven north instead, then it was only 15 minutes until the lights and population of Columbia were left behind for rural back roads and wooded areas. Then, of course, there's the Broad River, running from Buncombe County, North Carolina, to Columbia, where it meets the Congaree River, right next to Columbia. While these are dark avenues to explore, the sad fact of the matter is, there's a lot of land and water in that area, which could present an assailant with a lot of options in terms of remote locations to both commit a crime and dispose of a body. There's also Columbia itself, with various abandoned homes that could contain many secrets. Investigators had ripped up the floor of one home in search of answers, but there are far too many to dig into all of them without some sort of tip or guidance. It's difficult to accept, but the stranger abduction scenario is almost too broad to even have a chance of narrowing possibilities. Columbia is a city of more than 130,000 residents, and that's a very large suspect pool to draw from. The possibilities that this could have been an abduction, a robbery gone wrong, or something worse, exist without the ability to really rule much out. Investigators spoke to hundreds of people in the area in hopes of discerning some information, but no one appeared to be in possession of any, or they chose not to reveal what they knew. The last time Dale Dinwiddie was seen was around 1:30 a.m. Her father discovered she hadn't returned home just under 5 hours later, around 6:15 a.m. That opens up a radius of approximately 300 miles with Columbia at the center. In 5 hours, an abductor could have taken Dale as far north as West Virginia, as far south as Jacksonville, Florida, and as far west as Alabama or Tennessee. Now, the likelihood that the perp traveled that great of a distance is slim, but either way you slice it, that's a lot of area to cover. There didn't appear to be anything in Dale's life to suggest a potential suspect. No major issues with other people, no fights or a history of threats, no jealous boyfriends or ex-boyfriends lurking about. Police dug into the people in Dale's life and couldn't make any connections, which again adds fuel to the fire that there's a good chance this was a random crime. It's a hard thing to acknowledge, but with Dale having been missing for nearly 30 years now, there are really only two possibilities. Either someone took her life, or she's alive but being held somewhere she can't escape or get help from. The latter is far less likely, and while local police refuse to suggest that Dale may have been murdered, they also know that statistically speaking, the likelihood that she's still alive is fairly slim. So what you have to ask yourself is, how likely is it that someone would have seen a beautiful young woman, small of stature and extremely slim, walking down a Columbia City street all on her own after 1 a.m. and decided to make a horrible choice to abduct her? Unfortunately, in today's world, that possibility is quite high. So, it's absolutely possible that Dale was abducted by a stranger. This is the theory most law enforcement has gotten behind in the past 30 years, in that they've never had a breakthrough anywhere else. People talk, they make mistakes, and it's believed that if a person responsible for Dale's disappearance was someone she knew, or someone she had encountered in the past, someone would have heard or seen something by now. What's truly disturbing is that, for nearly three decades, that person or persons have been walking the streets for free, while Dale's family has suffered in the desperate limbo of unknowing. Though for some, they believe that Dale's attacker may in fact already be known and sitting on death row. And that takes us into our second theory, that Dale may have been a victim of serial killer Ronaldo Rivera. Born in Madrid, Spain, in September of 63, Ronaldo Rivera would have been 29 years old when Dale disappeared from the streets of Colombia. By this time, he'd already served in the Navy and been on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's currently in prison for four murders, all of which took place between the years of 1999 and 2000. The four victims were Melissa Dinges, 17 years old, Tiffany Wilson, 17, Tabitha Bosdell, also 17, and Marnie Glista, 21. All four were murdered by way of strangulation. However, these are only the four confirmed murders of Rivera. He is suspected in more crimes reaching back as far as 1987, when Rivera would have been just 24 years old, only 1 year older than Dale was when she disappeared. We know that Rivera was in Colombia during the time that Dale vanished, as he was attending the University of South Carolina, having enrolled just 1 year prior, in 1991. It's somewhat difficult to look completely away from Rivera as a suspect because of the fact that he was in the area and had a penchant for targeting young women. While his victims were predominantly under the age of 18, at least one wasn't, and for anyone who has ever seen images of Dale, her size and youthful appearance certainly made it possible that someone could have mistaken her for being several years younger than she was. Obviously, Rivera was resourceful and effective in his crimes, and while nothing has ever been found to tie him to Dale, nothing has ever been found to completely rule him out either. Two of Rivera's victims were from Aiken County, South Carolina. Between Aiken County and Richland County, in which Columbia is located, is only one other county, Lexington. It seems quite clear that Rivera was comfortable and practiced in working his crimes in South Carolina. Hell, the town of Aiken, at the center of Aiken County, is less than 60 miles to the west of Columbia. I think when you've got a guy like this with a history such as the one Rivera has, and it's known that he committed murders within an hour's drive of the last place that Dale Dinwiddie was ever seen, it's pretty difficult to not want to dig deeper into him. Unfortunately, he isn't talking. Rivera has been sitting on death row for nearly 15 years now, and the only conversations he's had in regard to Dale have been to deny his involvement. But what else can you expect from someone like this? I think Rivera's a good possibility. The man attended SCU, which would have put him within a few miles radius of all the places that Dale went the night she disappeared. I've also always wondered what the chances were that Dale may have seen him around campus in the past. I'm not suggesting that they knew one another. All evidence seems to be to the contrary, but it's a big campus with a lot of people walking around. It's not impossible that Dale could have seen him before. If she had, and she remembered his face as someone from school, how much more likely would she have been to hop in the car if he offered a ride? That's all speculative, but it's possibilities such as these that make Rivera seem like such a good possibility. Sadly, unless someone can be found to establish a link, Rivera is unlikely to ever face punishment for what he may have done to Dale. While Rivera is certainly a topic in need of more exploration, the idea that Dale may have been lulled into a state of safety by a would-be attacker is one which has been considered as well. As previously mentioned with Rivera, were Dale familiar with her perpetrator, she may have gone along believing this person was going to help her out. By the time she realized something was wrong, it likely would have been too late. We know that Dale was somewhat timid, and so, short of someone brandishing a weapon and forcing her into a vehicle, we have little which makes us believe she'd have just accepted a ride from a stranger. But what about the possibility of someone else that she may have known, even if only by sight? That leads us into the third and final theory. With a case as wide open as this one, almost all theories have to be considered at one time or another. Many people have considered that Dale could have been taken by someone she knew, and some of the aforementioned reasons could grant support to that theory. More than 30,000 students attend the University of South Carolina at any given time, and that opens up the potential for a lot of possible suspects. Acquaintances, classmates, even faculty can't be ruled out. Someone could have developed an infatuation with Dale, or simply could have recognized her on that fateful September night and saw an opportunity. If we're talking about a student, faculty member, or even someone who simply worked on or near campus, then there's a good chance we're talking about someone who at a minimum had some familiarity with the area, be it Columbia or the surrounding wilderness. This would give this person a lot of different options when it came to finding a place to commit a crime or perhaps conceal a body. We know that Dale was not a stupid person. She was bright and untrusting of strangers, so again, it doesn't seem likely she'd just go along with anyone, unless of course she was forced. So, is it possible that someone Dale knew, even if only by sight, could have offered her a ride or convinced her to come along? Absolutely. Just imagine it. It's after 1 a.m. and you've got Dale, who doesn't like being out in the city at night on her own, walking around after having been separated from her friends. You can probably imagine some level of panic in her, that realization that she's on her own. What might someone do under those circumstances? We know that Dale wasn't shy about calling her parents to come get her, should the need arise, so I guess you've got to ask yourself why she chose to walk further into the city on her own that night, rather than using the phone at the bar to catch a ride. It seems like she was really focused on finding her friends, or anyone she may have known. Given the vulnerable state of her mind at that time, plus we have no idea how much she may or may not have drank that night, which could have contributed to her confusion, you've got a situation just ripe for someone to try and manipulate her into a bad position. We all know what that feels like, don't we? When you're out with some people and all of a sudden you turn around and everyone's gone, there's that little moment of panic there. Take that little moment of panic and stretch it out over a short period of time during which Dale was looking for her friends. It's not hard to imagine that she could have been freaking out a little bit, and even a somewhat familiar face may have been calming to her in that moment. If she were worried, if she were buzzed, if she was wandering the city looking for her friends, she might have been a little more receptive to someone she didn't directly know. Or perhaps even someone who she recognized, or perhaps they recognized her, and made note of a class they shared, or something about USC, where they could possibly have known one another. That would certainly be disarming in that moment, and if this person were to offer help, be it a ride home, or even a ride around to look for her friends, I don't know that Dale would have offhandedly dismissed taking the ride. I don't know that I would have either. I didn't know Dale, so it's not for me to say, but the possibility remains. To me, it seems apparent that, were this what happened, as soon as Dale took a seat in this person's car, it was already too late. And we can't rule out the possibility of someone at that bar. Imagine someone at the bar, sees Dale or has a conversation with her, runs into her later that night on the street, sees her looking for her friends and says, "Hey, remember me? We talked at the bar." And you're already halfway there. How hard is it really to convince someone to get into the car if they're looking for their friends and they've had a conversation with you or slightly recognize you, or you're able to depict yourself as someone who might go to school with them or is friends with one of their friends? It's a sad set of circumstances, but again, almost anything is possible here. The disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie is an incredibly disturbing, haunting, and frustrating case. Harold Chambers spent the last 12 years of his life trying to figure out what could have happened to the 23-year-old. Jean, Dan, and Drew have spent nearly 30 years wondering what could have become of their daughter and sister, hoping against hope that someday they might have that answer and perhaps be afforded the ability to lay Dale to rest and face the cold darkness of closure. For now, we know almost as little as we knew 30 years ago. In December of 2008, Dale's profile was entered into NamUs, utilizing DNA obtained from her hairbrush. In the 11 years since, 9 Jane Does have been compared to her profile, and 9 have been ruled out as possibilities. With advancements in technology happening almost every day, the possibility remains that Dale may be found, but that is a hope which is almost too difficult for some to cling to. We know almost nothing when it comes to this case, but one thing we know beyond argument is that somewhere out there, someone knows exactly what became of Dale Dinwiddie. This person or persons possesses knowledge that could offer a family the ability to mourn, to grieve, to confront the monster of loss without disruption. There's nothing comforting in spending the rest of your life wondering what became of a loved one, and while finding them deceased is not comforting either, it does at least provide an answer. Can you imagine never knowing what happened to someone you love? It's a horrifying way to live, wondering if each new phone call will be the one that finally brings an answer, or if you're going to go to your grave never knowing the truth. Hopefully, sooner than later, some piece of evidence will be found, a confession will be confirmed, or someone will come forward with information to move the investigation in the right direction. Until that day, the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie, there are many online forums and news articles available. The Greenville News has a comprehensive series examining her disappearance. If you want to look into more information about Dale Dinwiddie, you can pull up her NamUs profile under number MP262. If you have any information about the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie, please contact the Columbia, South Carolina Police Department under the care of Investigator Mark Vinson at 803-545-3500. Dale's case number is 923-1749. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. What app are you using to listen to podcasts? I've been using the Himalaya app, and I really love the setup. It's so much easier and streamlined than many others. But there's an added bonus with Himalaya. Through the app, you can become a supporter of Trace Evidence. Without even having to leave the app, you can sign up for a small monthly fee that goes directly to production costs for the show. And in return, you'll receive ad-free episodes and access to upcoming monthly bonus premium episodes. If you'd like to test this out, visit Himalaya.com/Trace Evidence and use the promo code Evidence for 1 month free. Once you get used to ad-free episodes and bonus content, you won't want to turn back. As some of you are aware, on Patreon, I will begin posting one episode per month that is not available in the normal feed beginning in September. In these episodes, I'll discuss a variety of cases, including solved cases, which are voted on monthly by patrons. These episodes will also be available through the Himalaya podcast app for those who become premium members. But speaking of Patreon, it's time for a shout out to our amazing Patreon producers: Angie Dodd, Emily Smith, Megan Cotter, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Robbie Blue, Brian Kemmerling, Wannabe Sleuth 2, Laura Dickinson, Julia Rexon, Diane Dyson, Tom Archer, Eamon Brady, Nick Mohar Schurz, Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Randy Wyland, Brittany Bivens, Glenda Piper, and Megan. You're all amazing, and if you're new and I mispronounced your name, just shoot me a message and I'll correct it. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence, and for all your nice comments on social media. They've meant a lot to me these last couple of weeks. Just a quick update regarding the release schedule of Trace Evidence. I've been batting back and forth the possibility of releasing on Tuesdays versus Mondays. So for the next couple of weeks, you're probably going to see some alternating there. An episode will come out on Monday, and then the next week an episode will come out on Tuesday. And there's a good chance that in 2020, I'm going to permanently switch the schedule to Tuesday. So just wanted to give you guys a heads up on that. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.